Hello, dreamers, thinkers, and doers. Welcome to Ideate with Florian. In this season, we discover where good ideas come from, whether it's for a new feature, product, or company. I'm your host, Florian Hoornaert. For over 25 years, I work with small and medium-sized companies in engineering, sales, and management. During that time, I connected with many professionals to grow together. That makes me excited to explore the journeys of our guests with you. So let's dive in. Episode 3. Incremental Ideas Make Money with Thomas Stortjegong. In this episode of the Ideate with Florian podcast, we're excited to feature Thomas Stortjegong, a professional with a background in major global corporations. Drawing from his vast experience, Thomas shares his insights into driving innovations within companies. We explore the challenges and dynamics of innovation, from who is responsible for the innovation within companies to cross-functional dynamics. Thomas delves into both incremental and disruptive innovation, shedding light on why incremental innovation is most likely to yield success. Thomas discusses the cultural aspects of fostering innovation within an organization, touching upon the need for a shift in mindset and internal processes. Join us for a thought-provoking conversation with Thomas on innovation, corporate culture, and the intricacies of bringing groundbreaking ideas to life. Well, Thomas, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Florian. It's great to be here.
Today, we're going to talk about innovation. Typically, my background is more in smaller companies and startups, and that's not for your expertise.
No, Florian, I started out in some of the biggest companies in the planet, and my background actually is at Ford, and I was kind of, in a way, born to work there. My dad worked at Ford for 35 years. I grew up just outside of Detroit in a city called Dearborn, which is where the headquarters of Ford are. I grew up in a Ford historic home, so there was a neighborhood of historic homes that Henry Ford built. The house was built in 1920. I went to Edsel Ford High School. Our mascot was the Thunderbird, and I could sit in history class and watch the prototypes drive out of the design center as I was growing up. So yeah, I was pretty much headed for a big mega company from the get-go. I spent 10 years at Ford, loved every minute of it. But yeah, that was where I cut my teeth in corporate America, was at a large multi-billion dollar global firm. So yeah, long way from the startup world.
That's definitely corporate there, and also innovative, I guess. I mean, we all know Henry Ford and his assembly lines as a mascot of innovation. You were there. I'm very much eager to talk to you on this season where we talk about innovation, where we talk about ideation, we start new companies, because I want to hear from you. And this is the conversation we're going to have, I hope. Where lies the opportunities for smaller companies? How do larger corporates innovate? How do they do it? What are their tricks for trade? What are they good at? And perhaps also, where do they drop the ball? And where is an opportunity for smaller companies? So can we just start off, just to paint a picture, like an everyday example of what you do within a company?
I help companies find better ideas and bring them to life. So I'm an independent consultant. I work with companies that are struggling to grow through innovation, whether they're just launching bad ideas that aren't hitting in the market, or they're struggling to take their ideas through their own internal processes and bring them out to market. I help those companies just find better ideas and then grow by launching things that consumers and their customers love. So that's kind of my sweet spot. So I work on innovation strategy. I help with brainstorming. I do some innovation training. That's kind of the main areas that I dig into.
And what kind of organization size do you typically consult with?
Small companies. I now, it's funny because most of my career has been in multi-billion dollar companies. Now I focus on smaller companies. I find that I'm able to help them really quickly. I can add a lot of value. If there's a need there, a lot of them don't have the expertise that some of the larger companies have. So I like taking what I've learned over 20 some years in corporate America and helping smaller companies innovate.
And what kind of organization size are we talking about? Is that like 10 people in a company, 100? What is small in your...
Yeah, it's hundreds. So it's 10 to hundreds. It's not thousands to, it's 10 thousands. It's tens of people to hundreds of people. Some of them don't even have an innovation group or a product group. Some of them do, but they just need some help or some guidance or some extra strategy. Usually sweet spots, let's call it $10 to $100 million in revenue. we can go large. I go larger, but that's kind of the sweet spot.
Okay. So in a smaller company, you typically, I mean, I really talk about a startup here. You immediately speak to the CEO, the chief product officers, the CTO, the founders at least. So in these, in my mind, bigger companies, you call them smaller, we're talking about tens of people, hundreds of people. So,
it's relative. It's all relative, right?
Yeah, it's all relative. It's a matter of perspective. So in those companies who have grown out of the startup phase, who's responsible for innovation there?
So for me, it all starts with the president or the CEO. It's the same people.
Right.
Because if the president or the CEO isn't behind it, it's not going to happen. And here's the reason for it. And this is what I've learned in big companies is innovation is an all skate and everybody has to participate. It's not an option. So we can't put innovation in one group and hope the company is going to be innovative. The whole company needs to be innovative. And so when we're looking at evaluating and developing and bringing ideas to life, everybody's going to be involved. Sales, marketing, finance, manufacturing, operations. They all need to be a part of it. So if the president is not focused or the CEO is not focused on being innovative, the company's not going to follow. Right. And you can't put innovation in one group and hope that it gets through or you get something new out of it, because that's just not the way it works. It's everybody has to play together. Everybody has to come together to get the ideas done. And they need to be along for the journey. They need to be along that whole process. Now they have different roles to play and different amounts of time they play. But if they're not involved in the whole process, it breaks down. And I see that time and time again. So to me, innovation starts at the top.
So there's a finance team and an HR team and a product delivery team and an innovation team. That's not how it works.
Yeah. There's a team that can lead innovation, but if I come in and they tell me there's the innovation team and they don't interact with anybody and they're not bringing in the finance team and they're not bringing in accounting or sales or marketing or operations, then that's the problem, right? You can have somebody who's in charge of it and leading it, but if they're not working cross-functionally, it will break down.
I guess that's the same in a really small company as well. It's a team effort. Like you need to have all the disciplines and all the skill sets, from technical skills to marketing skills, from finance skills. You need to combine them. So that doesn't change the company size. No,
it doesn't. And Florian, I'll give you an example. I joined a company once and they had a brand new product that the engineers had developed. So the engineers had gone off and developed this great product. They were part of the marketing team at this company and they developed a marketing launch and they had made cookies, you know, to announce this new product within the company, right? So this thing is, pardon the pun, but it was well baked, right? This product was done and ready to go.
Okay.
And then they showed it to the operations team.
Right.
Okay. Like they had done all this work, gotten it all ready. Then they showed it to operations and operations said, well, it doesn't work in our equipment. We can't do it. And it died. Like multi-million-dollar investment in this new product died because they hadn't bothered to talk to the people who were going to live with the product on a day-to-day basis. And so that's the thing you really want to avoid. Everybody's got to come along for the journey. Everybody's got to have a part in the story. So when it gets to their role to take it over to manage it, they've already bought into it. And that's the beauty of working, doing innovation cross-functionally. Otherwise, you're fighting an uphill stream, trying to get every new department to accept your idea. And it's just a battle. And you can't get things out the door that way.
So if we would keep a list of the problems that larger corporations struggle with innovation, is this like a number one that you have to do it cross boundaries, cross-functional, cross teams? And that's hard by itself?
Yeah, that is one of the hardest things. And it is one of the top things that I see. And part of the problem is it's the companies, certainly as you get bigger, the companies start to incentivize the different departments to do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So think about if I'm the manufacturing team, I'm running the manufacturing team. Well, the incentive or the metric I'm going to get for the year is going to be to reduce costs by 10%.
Right.
So I am focused on that. Well, you're the innovation team now comes over and says, hey, I want to do this new thing that's going to cost money. Well, I don't want to hear about it because that goes against what I'm getting paid to do.
Right.
And my bonus and all my incentive is to make everything cost less. Your new widget is really cool, but it's going to slow me down because I haven't been doing it for 10 years. I got to source all new parts technology that I haven't been buying in bulk that I can't get cheap. Right. I mean, there's all these things. I got to add labor because your process isn't refined. You know, there's just so the incentives naturally within corporations start to split teams apart because they start to focus in on doing their own thing. And that's what drives the division. So if you're not bringing those folks in very early and getting buy-in, you've got to break all of those hurdles as the innovation team every time you go talk to somebody else. I mean, the sales team is the same way. Their sales incentives are set up based on volume and revenue. And you come and say, hey, I got this new product. Yeah, we hope it will be 2% of revenue next year. Nobody in sales wants to talk to you. I mean, it doesn't help them hit their bonuses. You know,
they don't have a funnel yet for the new product, but they still need to hit their sales quota, right?
Yeah. So why spend time on that or spend time on the big thing that already makes all the money and I already have a Rolodex of 500 people I can call to sell more of those?
Right.
You know, so that's where the big companies start to struggle is that cross-functional dynamic.
Right.
You know, they see innovation as a thing. We have an innovation team. The innovation team is doing their thing. Great. We're now innovating.
So the largest organization that I ever worked for was, we were 3,500 people. And after that, I think the max was about 100. So that's my experience. I always look in awe at the sheer unlimited budgets, unlimited manpower that corporates have. Am I looking at corporates in a too rosy way?
So in response to that, I would say like when I was at Ford, one of my key memories of my 10 years at Ford was they had all the toys. Like they did have all the toys. So they have all of the resources to do great things. And I think that's why you can see large corporations really good at incremental innovation. Because they got they can get the process down to refining and adding features and changing and, you know, incrementally doing new things because they can research it, study it, and dive into it better than anybody else.
And then incremental innovation that is like we built this widget and now we're getting better at building that widget, right?
Exactly.
So incrementally, step by step, driving down costs and improving quality.
Okay, yeah. So let's talk about incremental innovation a little bit with an example that everybody can use. So we're up to the iPhone 15 now. And if you think about it, that's 15 versions of the iPhone. And again, this holds true for the Android phones or whatever platform phone you want to use. It's an incremental innovation from iPhone 1 to 15. Fundamentally, we haven't disrupted the smartphone market since the smartphone came out. The smartphone was a disruption, but the next 15 years have not been disruptions. But it has been improved so much that you would not want to use an iPhone from 10 years ago anymore. So if you think about all the incremental innovations that Apple did to get us from 1 to 15, along the way, it's become such a better product that you don't want to go backwards. And that's when we start talking about incremental innovation. That's what we're talking about. Similarly, if we go back to Ford, because I love the auto industry, you don't really want a car from 30 years ago in terms of horsepower, convenience, connectivity for your technology, fuel mileage, safety. It's just not a car you want to drive. And that's all incremental innovation. And again, Henry Ford was disruptive to the marketplace. He didn't invent the car, but his manufacturing processes were disruptive in a way that he could offer more people cars so they could get off of horses, which is a huge disruption, right? To leave horses to get to cars. But if we think about that, the next 100 years, because Ford it's well over a 100-year-old company at this point, has all been incremental innovation. So there's I'm wandering from your topic here a little bit, but there's a ton of money to be made in incremental innovation versus the disruption. The disruption happens once. But Ford has made, I mean, I don't know how many billions of dollars, maybe trillions of dollars over the next 100 years, incrementally innovating and offering the customer a better product within the same product category.
Right. And now you're nailing the topic of the show, I think, is that going from iPhone 1 to iPhone 15 is incremental. Now you increment from 1 to 2, from 2 to 3, etc. But the other type of innovation that you mentioned was disruptive innovation. And that's where you go from zero to one. And it's at this point, it's really hard to not mention Peter Thiel's book, From Zero to One, which I think is an excellent book. And the other book that we can also mention here, when we talk about disruptive versus incremental, is The Innovator's Dilemma. We're not going to talk too much about that because that's a different author. But the theme and the terms are clear, right? Disruptive, going from zero to one, incremental from 1 to 15. And what I hear you say is that larger corporates, they are better equipped to go incremental than disruptive, or maybe even they are from naturally inclined to do incremental instead of disruptive.
I would also add they are probably, so I agree with both those, but I would also add they're incentivized to do incremental.
Right.
So it goes back to the conversation we had earlier. Once you get going on a certain product, each organization is incentivized around that product. The CEO becomes incentivized around that product. Again, I have a product that's making, you know, millions or hundreds of millions of dollars in the marketplace. I'm going to spend my time there as opposed to spending my time on this thing that's the 0 to 1. There's a whole lot more money to be made in their mind at the moment in the current product, the large product that they have on offer, than there is on the disruptive innovation that, again, if they only sell one or two of next year, right, it's not even in the same category. So there's an incentive that gets built around the key product categories, which is one of the reasons it's harder for big companies to disrupt themselves.
Right.
Incrementally, they have all the experts, they can buy all the toys, they can do all the research, and you can justify all kinds of spending to incrementally make something better next year. Because it's very easy. There's a direct ROI and you can see it.
Right. And there where you mentioned time, you have to mention, I guess, in my mind, I think immediately short-term, long-term, right?
Yeah.
So in the short-term, you can make more money in incremental small steps. And does it also mean, and I'm filling in blanks here, that in the long-term, disruptive would give you more proceeds?
So disruptives give somebody new an entrance into the marketplace to restart that incremental curve over,
right?
If that makes sense. So once you have a disruption, that whole who's going to make money off the incremental starts over. So Apple introduced the smartphone, but there's been a whole bunch of other people that have incremented the Android phones and so forth. Samsung's made a ton of money off of Apple's disruption. It's not just the person who does the disruption, but then everybody has to chase each other to keep up on the incremental scale, or you get left behind.
So if I'm mining a current project, and I think the right term is you have a cash cow that you're cashing out. You got this cash cow, this product that is just generating money. That makes sense to do that. But then you also know that the cash cow will one day die off, and then you need a next cow. And to get that next cow,
yes,
you would need disruptive innovation. But that is long-term, and companies by themselves through their shareholders, they're incentivized for the short term. Are we onto something here?
Absolutely. You are completely onto something. And it goes back to that 0 to 1. Going from 0 to 1, there's just not as much money as the cash cow. So what gets my time? What gets my attention? Where am I being incentivized? All of those things are leading us to keep the cash cow going,
right,
and not come up with the new disruptive innovation, which is why a lot of times disruptions happen outside of companies. I mean, you can go back to Kodak, right? The film company. I mean, they had the patents for the digital camera long before it was released, but they were so focused on the cash cow and the quality was so much different, they couldn't see people adopting to the digital,
right?
And they got left behind because they couldn't see it, even though they had it. The cash cow was so much bigger and so much more important in the moment, they couldn't see this product being a disruption.
And are there companies on the other side, corporates who actually did take a more disruptive innovation? I'm thinking about Netflix, for instance. Is that a good example?
All right. So let's talk about companies that have disrupted themselves, large companies. So Netflix itself was a disruption, the Blockbuster. A lot of people give them credit for being a disruption because they went to mailing versus, you know, in-store. One of the biggest things Netflix actually disrupted that Blockbuster couldn't get over was Netflix eliminated late fees. And people don't talk about that a lot, but that is actually a huge customer pain point that Blockbuster had that Netflix eliminated. And I think, and I'm going to get the number wrong, I think it was somewhere between 10 to 20% of Blockbuster's revenue was late fees. And they had the opportunity to buy Netflix very, very early on and didn't. I mean, I think it was like for $50 million. They could have bought Netflix for $50 million early on and did not buy them, partly because they were so stuck on this cash cow of late fees. Now, Netflix offered a different level of convenience. I was an early Netflix adopter myself. To some extent, it was less convenient than Blockbuster because I had to wait a couple days to get the movie I wanted. And I had to think ahead of, as opposed to, oh, I'm just going to go grab a movie. But the late fee thing was such a big deal. It was one of the reasons they gained a lot of traction. Now, so going back to companies that disrupted themselves, Netflix has done a good job of that by moving from the mailing and sending out DVDs to moving into the on-demand video streaming And so that is a company that has done a disruption on itself and fundamentally changed kind of who they are. But they themselves were the disruption to begin with.
So let's say that I'm the CEO of a large corporation. I see the market. I see my company. I know exactly what we're doing. We're milking the cash cow. I also see that my cash cow is at the end of the product life cycle. I need a next thing. I come to you and say, Thomas, help me do disruption. What's the plan? What's that step number 1, 2, 3, 4? How does that work?
Yeah. So if you're going to take on, you know, and try to disrupt yourself, it's a really big challenge. So when we talked about innovation before, I said, look, big corporations, we got to be cross-functional. Everybody needs to be cross-functional to get things out the door. When you start talking about disruption, it's you almost need to pull it out. Like it almost needs to be a separate entity for all the reasons we just talked about. If you come up with an idea you think is going to disrupt your cash cow, you need to start incentivizing people like a startup. So this is where it starts. You need to start putting that startup mentality within the corporation. So you need to incentivize people to get this new disruption out the door. They need to spend 100% of their time on it. They need to be totally focused on the customer and relentless on that particular customer who's going to help them disrupt the market. And when we talked about the barriers earlier, it was time, it's incentives, it's, you know, it's all those kind of things that need to be changed for a group of people to get that disruption into the marketplace. And that's where big companies really struggle with it, is because they don't incentivize people to bring the disruption out. It starts to compete with a cash cow and it will never win. So we can come up with the big ideas. I think when we talk about, I think this might be interesting for your listeners too. If you want to come up with a disruptive idea, one of the easiest places to start is finding out customers' pain points with the existing product. So if you can start to eliminate pain points with either the product or the business model or the service, now you're on to something. Figure out what the number one customer problem is and go after that.
Right.
You know, is it how do I pay? Is it how do I get it? Is it how do I receive it? How do I consume it? If you can challenge that, you've got an idea for a disruption. Then if you're talking about being in a big company, you need people who wake up and are focused every day, 100% of their day is how to make that thing succeed. Because that's what the startup mentality is. I mean, those are, right? If you're in a startup, that's what you're doing every day. You're waking up every day. Every day is do or die. I have to make this work so that it can get out there. And that's hard to get in a corporate environment where things compete with a cash cow, which is why I say when you start to do disruption in a large corporation, it needs to be separate.
Right. That's also what Clayton Christensen, the author of Innovator's Dilemma, says, that it needs to be a separate entity. Either it exists and you buy it, or yep, you set it up. I think that's also in line with what Steve Jobs once said, is that you have to start with the customer in mind. And you can't say, okay, this is what we invented and this is some new technology. How can we bring that to the customer? Now you have to start with the customer and then think back from there. Like, what do we need to build to actually deliver value to them? And that is not going to happen within an existing structure. So is this also where the word intrapreneur comes from? Intrapreneur versus entrepreneurs?
Yeah, from trying to do it on the inside.
So what's your experience with intrapreneurs? What kind of people are those?
They are, one, relentless.
Okay.
They need to be, you know, because there's a lot of corporate inertia that they're fighting against, typically. They definitely can see a vision that other people don't see, but they also have to be able to lead people to that vision. And they have to be very good at bringing people along. So not only sharing the vision, but bringing people along that journey and bringing them along on that story to help get the thing out the door.
The future of work is flexible. If you are being mandated to return to the office, fear not. There are things that you can do to create flexibility for yourself, and there are things that you can do to prepare for the inevitable flexibility that is coming your way. Collaboration Superpowers helps people and companies work better together from anywhere. And we've got a free remote working success kit to get you started. From personal user manuals to team agreements, virtual icebreakers, and more, download the Remote Working Success Kit at collaborationsuperpowers.com. We'll see you online.
When I think of entrepreneurs, I always think about disruption, and I think of people who just go through brick walls. But what I hear from you now is that they're more diplomats.
I mean, there's some that are just rogue that run through every brick wall and believe, you know, that just wild by nature in terms of their ideas and what they want to come up with, which is great. But if they want to actually succeed, then you've got to play within the system to some extent, or play around the system within the company. And there's still that, you know, you're still dealing with everybody else in the company. And so you can't go totally rogue and totally on your own, but you can do things that are different within the system that make people, that change the way things happen.
That's really walking a tightrope, because your task is like, okay, go do something new, but don't forget that you have to do it within our structure. Is that a fair representation?
Well, you've got to do something new, but you can cheat the structure. So I'll give you an example. So, and this is a very small example, but at one point I was in charge of changing the culture in a company and making it more innovative. And so we decided we were going to do some, let's call them iconic things, and just do things people would remember, right? We're just going to do some things people. And we were doing a lot of innovation training within the company at that time. I think, you know, we trained over 500 people in the company on innovation. And one of the things we wanted to do was, rather than give them a handout at the end of the training, we wanted to have an app.
Okay.
So, I mean, this was early days. We're talking, I don't know, 15 years ago, maybe somewhere around there, 10 to 15 years ago. And I hired a kid out of college who was a summer intern, and he wanted to learn how to make apps. And I said, look, I need an app. So I paid him a couple grand as an intern to create this app. And it was just basically a story card app. You flipped them and it gave you new information. That was the whole app.
Okay.
But the IT department told me it was going to be $80,000, right, to do the app. They didn't have an app. And they, you know, it was going to be 6 months. Well, this kid knocked one out for us in like, I don't know, was it like 6 weeks, I think? Because, again, it's so simple, he was learning. And then we figured out, he talked to some people behind the scenes in IT, and we figured out how to kind of bootleg it through the system so that people could download this app. I mean, I got in all kinds of trouble for it. Like, let's be honest. But at the end of the day, everybody was really impressed. And we started to, the company started going, oh, these apps are a real thing. We should get into apps. Like, we need to develop our own. All because, yeah, we operated within the system, but kind of next to the system, and we went around it where we couldn't work with it, if that makes sense.
That makes sense, yeah.
So it's a little bit of knowing and being able to play with the system, but play around the system where you get stuck.
So when you build an app for $1,000 instead of $80,000 that the IT department quoted, you're going to cut some corners. I can also imagine that not everyone's going to be happy with that, because they'll be ridiculed, like, oh, you needed $80,000 for this. Yeah, how can you, you know, look at this guy doing a way better job than you. How does that work? Just in general, corporate, not a specific incident, of course. I don't want to focus on that, but like in general.
Here's key to that. I had air cover. If you're going to have an entrepreneur in a company, you've got to give them air cover to do new and different things. Did I take some heat? Absolutely, I took some heat. But at the end of the day, was I worried about my job? No, because my boss loved the fact that I was challenging the organization.
Right.
And you've got to have the air cover to do it. So whatever level you are at as an entrepreneur, you've got to have somebody above you saying, I want you to go push buttons and change things. That is absolutely huge. You could try to be an entrepreneur on your own, but I think people will get sick of you because you're just always messing things up and you're always doing things differently. But if you've got some air cover and somebody above you sees the need to change, then you have a lot of freedom to go do new and different things.
So the takeaway here is also, if you're going to be an entrepreneur in a corporate, don't expect that you're going to make a lot of friends immediately.
No, you'll get a lot of attention, and a lot of people will be interested in what you're doing, because people naturally want to know what the future looks like. And so if you're the one who is out there working on the future all the time, it's very interesting to people. But you will upset some people, and you've got to be good at that. You've got to have thick skin. You got to be resilient, but you need air cover. Because if you do it without air cover, then you're just kind of the jerk in the company telling everybody to do things differently.
Right? Yeah, there's this rogue element that needs to be eliminated. You're this virus that is invading the body, and that the body wants to get rid of naturally. Yeah.
No, you still take heat. You know, I still screw things up. Other entrepreneurs are going to screw things up, because then you're trying things in a system that's not used to somebody trying things or failing at something. And so you've got to be willing to fail in front of people and go, that didn't work, we'll never do it again, or unless, you know, we'll only come back, so let's go over here now. And so there's a lot of that that, you know, again, I think it's a lot probably similar to the startup world, but you're just doing it, you know, with a lot of headwind. And the headwind isn't, I don't have resources or I don't have people. It's the rest of the company wants to squish me out to some extent. So there's different challenges, but similar, I think, mindsets.
Yeah, you're tearing down walls that other people put up there for a reason, or that have been there for decades. Nobody knows where they're there, but they're used to there being a wall now, and you're tearing down that wall.
Yeah, and sometimes that wall is their safety net.
Right, and that's where you need the diplomacy, you know, your own diplomatic skills of being able to work with a lot of people and having that air cover from higher up and saying, no, no, this guy is actually, he's doing, I'm going to take the heat for him a bit.
Yeah, I launched a new product within a company that had been around for 20 years and never launched a new product. So I launched the second product in a company's 20-year history. Okay,
wow.
Let's talk okay. about that. They gave me 10 months to do it.
And they've been around for 20 years.
They had been in this country for 20 years and they had one product.
Okay.
And it's actually a $1 billion company.
Okay.
It's fantastic. Chet Pallets in the U.S. It's a multi-billion-dollar global company. In the U.S., they manage 70 to 80 million, or at least when I was there, 70 to 80 million pallets in the U.S. They rent them, pool them, and they collect money on them. And they're in the U.S. system all the time. There's a global company, but in the U.S., we're talking about a $1 billion business. They had been in the U.S. for 20 years.
And we talk about the wood pallets, right? That you use for trucks. You transport stuff on them.
Yes. You can see them at Walmart, you know, your big home goods stores like Home Depot, you know, the big warehouses, those kind of stores. So they wanted to come out with a new product. They had 70 million of these things they treated as one SKU. They treated them all as the same. And they gave me 10 months to introduce SKU number 2 into this company. Okay.
It's going to be good.
It's fantastic. So I spent the first month recruiting people, to the point where the guy who sat in the cube next to me asked me if I had a psychology degree for the number of people I talked off the ledge.
Right. Right.
Like, no, we're going to do this. You're going to come along and help me because I can't do this myself. And the product was probably the simplest part of the whole thing. Because again, we're talking about pallets, wood nails and fasteners, right? Like it's not an airplane. It's not a rocket ship.
No.
But we broke every system in the company. I mean, you think about it. We have a 20-year history of managing one SKU, but now I don't know how to invoice. I don't know how to let the customer order. I don't know how to do a truckload of mixed things. You know, we don't know how to sell it. We don't know how to market it. And that, the biggest challenge wasn't the product in that standpoint. It was getting everybody else to participate and help get that product out the door.
That is so interesting. It's such a good reminder that you can have like the product with a small P, like that's just a physical thing or whatever you're selling. But then there's like the full product, like everything that supports that product actually going to the customer, going from sales, going to finance. That needs to be reinvented as well.
Absolutely. And that was the hardest part. It wasn't, I mean, we had the product done, I think, by month 5 or 6 out of 10. It was everything else that took all the time and where my stress level was. I mean, and at the end of the day, when it was done and we launched it, I sent out a little token. I went back and compiled a list of everybody who had significantly helped on the project. So significantly put time and effort into the project. And I sent out the little tokens to people as a memento of the project to over 105 people.
Wow.
Like I had recruited, I had nobody working for me. Like I was a individual contributor. Nobody reported to me. And we had at least 105 people from all different disciplines and organizations that put significant time and energy in making it work.
And can you share what the product is? This desk you with number 2? What was the second product ever?
Yeah, I don't even know if they still offer it, but it was a half pallet. So we literally cut a pallet in half.
Wow. That's a bit anticlimactic.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? So, I mean, but there were some innovations we put into it. We used, instead of all wood, it's got some metal blocks to allow it to work with different material handling equipment. We've got some, there were patents on it. But think about that, right? Like the issue there was not the product at all.
It's the internal processes and the culture actually shipping, doing something new, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the culture of doing something new, you have a hilarious anecdote that you shared with me about an innovation training for a global leadership thing you did.
Yeah. So when I think I mentioned earlier on this call, I used to do innovation training as part of a culture change piece. So when we were trying to start up an innovation program, we focused on three things: changing the culture, getting ideas out of people, and bringing those ideas to life. Right. So we want people to think differently. So you've got to empower people to think differently. And the best way I could come up with that to do that at scale was to start doing innovation training and just kind of talking people through, what does that look like? How do you have a conversation around being innovative? How do you come up with new ideas? I mean, basics that, you know, people haven't thought about for decades sometimes. And so we would just go around and we use this, what we call the training class, to just have that conversation with people. And so we called it innovation training, but it really was a conversation, and it was a chance to let them, in some extent, use a crayon again that they haven't used since they were a kindergartner. You know, I mean, it's that going back in and thinking, oh, I can come up with new ideas, or I have the knowledge to question why I do this, and it's okay. I'm frustrated every day. Why don't I question how to do this better?
Right.
You know, it's just giving people that. So we had started doing this process, and we had gained some traction, and we started to create a buzz in the company. And so we got invited to do various teams. And one of the teams we got invited to do was the leadership team for one of the global regions. And we found out kind of on our way there, somebody gave us some insight that this leadership team comes from all different countries. They met in the same hotel every quarter. They met in the same conference room in the same hotel every quarter. And they sat in the same seats in that conference room for every meeting they've ever had.
And now they're going to be innovative.
Yeah. And now they asked us, me and another guy that worked with me doing this training, and now they asked us to come and talk to them. So we got there and we're like, well, this is not happening. Like, we are just, this is not going to go down like they think it's going to go down. And that's going to be okay. But we wanted to signal to them early on that this is going to be a different conversation. So we got to the conference room early, pushed, you know, they had the typical conference U-shaped layout with the chairs around.
Right.
Everybody does it, right? So we shoved all that. We tore the room apart, shoved all that to the side, folded the tables down, and just had a semicircle of chairs. No names, no table. It was a semicircle of chairs, me and my training partner sitting next to me, and a flip chart. And then we turned on music. So we had some rock and roll going or something. I can't remember. And every person that joined, that came to this. Now, again, they stay in the same hotel. They go to the same conference room. They sit in the same chair every single time. They know where this conference room is. Every single one of them walked in the room. And we knew these people. These were not people we had never met before. We knew these people. They walked in, looked at us, and they would backpedal out of the room, reread the name on the door to make sure they were in this right conference room, and then walk in and say good morning. Like, it just floored them all. They just couldn't. It was so different. They couldn't deal with it.
Right. They're so used to doing the same thing over and over again, just a slightly better every day.
Yeah.
That when you do something completely different, they're completely off key.
Maybe it was too much. Maybe we pushed it too far. But, you know, the mental shift, I mean, it was a great opening to a conversation as well. Like, hey, why are you struggling with that? Like, why are you not used to new things? Let's talk about the fact that when things change, it's okay, you know? But yeah, that was one of the, like I said, I was given a lot of air cover at one point and was allowed to change and push buttons.
Yeah, you like to be a pirate. I get that.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun when you have the air cover to do it. When you don't have the air cover to do it, like I said before, you become a jerk, you know? And so you gotta figure out what the right way to do is.
So how do you see the relationship between corporates and startups?
So I think they have a lot to learn from each other. So I don't have a ton of startup exposure, right? But I think a lot of what startups struggle with, big corporates are probably good at in terms of processes and understanding how to do things systematically and get good results and innovate incrementally. But I think big companies get stuck in their ways. And I think startups excel at adapting and moving around challenges and eliminating challenges and jumping over things in ways that big companies can't or don't know how to do. And so I think there's a lot they can learn from each other. I always cringe a little bit when a big company buys a startup or buys a small company and then they proceed to integrate them.
Okay.
Right? Because
okay.
I think you lose a little bit of what made that startup great. And I think at some point, you know, the startup might get big enough on its own that integration makes sense. But when they're certainly when they're small and they get bought up, to me, a part of the startup died.
Yeah, what you see with Microsoft, they bought a few years ago, they bought a company called GitHub. I'm not sure if everyone is familiar with it, but it's basically a version control system for your software. So if you write code, you want to press Control S for save that code, but then you also want to store it in the cloud. And that's what GitHub does in a simplified way. But it stays as a separate brand. No, it's not all of a sudden Microsoft GitHub. No, it's still GitHub. So that's what you mean with state, keep it as a separate entity. And I think the same is true for a company like LinkedIn, which is also, again, bought by Microsoft like years ago, but also stayed their own entity.
The other one I would say is Dark Sky. I don't know if you're familiar with Dark Sky. It was a weather app.
Okay.
It was one of the better weather apps out there. And they had, and I think they were using a different technology to get their weather information, but it was great. I mean, I paid $3 for it because it was so much better than, you know, the Weather Channel or whoever else Apple or Google were using at the time. And Apple bought them. And a couple of years later, they shut Dark Sky down. And I don't know if they ended up taking the technology and sticking it into their own weather app. Mm-hmm. But certainly for those of us who loved Dark Sky, it just seemed like it ended. And maybe that technology was integrated, but maybe it wasn't. I don't know. But it seems like that was lost, right? That way of doing things differently and providing a better service to the customer, maybe it was integrated well. I don't know. But it's gone.
Yeah, it's definitely a way out for startups. I mean, when every startup wants to do an IPO, and it's a public offering where you get stocks and, you know, it's basically where everyone cashes out. Bankruptcy, definitely a popular option under startups. And then there's the strategic, right?
Yeah.
Where the startup is being bought by a larger company for some strategic reasons that the technology has been developed or access to a new group of customers. And that's what I hear you say when you say that corporates can be innovative by buying startups, but then not make the mistake by integrating them fully, but let them stay as their own entity and support them with resources, but don't take away their processes and culture.
Absolutely. Because once you try to make the startup fit into your culture, you lose a little bit of what made the startup great. And then it becomes more like just what you're doing. Now, if you're buying it to add it into a system or a process that you currently have, okay, maybe that makes sense. But if it's competing with your cash cow, bringing it into your system, you're going to lose a little bit of what made it great, you know?
Right. Yeah, and that's probably also why you buy a startup as a corporate, because it's in a market that is extremely adjacent to your cash cow. Because you wouldn't do something that is completely off topic. I mean, Ford will never go start an animation studio. Disney will buy an animation studio, but Ford won't do that, right? And that will cannibalize on your own product.
Yeah, and so that cannibalization internally is always tough to deal with. Because it goes back to incentives and time and where are we focusing our efforts. And if you're buying a startup, it's incrementally way smaller than the cash cow you're dealing with today. So it's always going to lose. Like, where are we going to invest money? If I invest $1 million in the startup or in the cash cow, which one do I get a better return on?
Yeah. And short term, right? That's the topic. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Short term thinking rules the day. Absolutely, Florian.
Well, Thomas, I had an absolute blast talking to you. We're going to wrap it up for this episode. I'm really glad that we got the perspective of large corporates in this season of how do you ideate as a small company, because this gives a perspective on where the opportunities are, where you have to be careful, even all the way through the end, like that a corporate could be an exit for a startup. So it was brilliant. Thank you.
No, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure and I've enjoyed the conversation. I've enjoyed getting to know you today as well.
Where can folks reach you if they later want to get in touch with you?
Yeah, so there's two great spots. One is look me up on LinkedIn, and then the second is my website, www.i2e.solutions. So those are both places I spend my time, and happy to connect with anybody who's interested in learning more.
And I will add those to the show notes, so you can just click a link and go see Thomas again. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Florian. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Florian.
And there you have it, another inspiring episode of the Ideate with Florian podcast. As always, I encourage you to visit our website at ideatewithflorian.com. That is ideatewithflorian.com. Here you will find links related to this episode as well as other episodes. My name is Florian Hornaert, and I hope this story inspired you. Thank you for joining me, and until next time.